Apologies. It's 2 minutes past six. My apologies. I would request that I keep my video on off. There's no shedding this side, and but I'm moving from one place that to another, where so that I'm within, I'm covered by network. I'm within network. If you grant me that, I would request that we start the meeting.
Recording in progress.
So the agenda is being presented tonight. Let me just look at the items. It's essentially two items. It's a briefing by the regular force. Operation Prosper employment letter. I think it's dated the 3rd of November, and then we do the minutes and we close the meeting. So this is the agenda for tonight. Nandipa, let me check. Do you have the quorum?
Good evening, Chair. Yes, we do, Chair.
We do have the quorum. Thank you very much. And colleagues, let me take apologies if there are any. Nandipa?
Evening, Chair, again. I have one apology from the Minister. That's the only apology that I have to.
That is the only apology you have. All right. Colleagues, are there any apologies that you may be aware of?
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Chairperson, is Mpolo Goro here in the Deputy Minister's office? I did say
for
the Deputy Minister.
Oh, for the Deputy Minister. Okay. Please, can you record the apology for the Deputy Minister? Thank you very much. Mr. Rahoro.
Honorable Chair,
Honorable Chair,
my sincere apology, Chair, I had arranged in the office to put in an apology because there is a function I was expected to be attending. I have decided last minute to call it off for reasons that are really not so necessary to be bothering the committee with, but I am in the meeting.
No, thank you very much, DM. DM, I'm going to conduct the meeting with the video off because I'm load shedded where I am, so I'm switching from this area to another area so that I'm within network. And I can start to offer the video. If you could just take note of that.
Noted, thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, thank you very much. And I'm not going to waste much time. We've done the apologies, and I think that takes care of item number two. And we'll then go to item number three. It's a briefing by the Regular Force Medical Continuation Fund. And I'm sure the sector would want to give us some remarks just to introduce the fund and who is in the meeting representing the fund.
Yes. Chairperson.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, no, Chairperson, I'm checking. I'm not sure if Mr. Mare has managed to connect, but I think, if it's not, I think it's because, he's attending something.
And Velim as well, it's away, and he sent me his apology that he has some other engagements to attend to. That, taking note of that, I'll then hand over either to the, I don't know who in the department is here, whether acting SecDef or the Chief of Staff.
Thank you, Chair. I'm the sector. I'm here. The Chief of Staff is supposed to be joining us. The presentation will be done by the Sergeant General of the SANDF. The Medical Continuation Fund is meant to continue providing medical services to members who have retired. So what happens is when they are still in service, there is an amount that they pay, like you will pay your medical aid, but it's a very little amount. But the principle is that they need to be looked after, medically speaking, by this medical fund when they retire, using mostly the military medical facilities still. Unless if they are not available, wherein then that will be outsourced. But the principle is that they should be catered for after they are, or when they retire and they are no longer in service. But I will allow the SG to then present to us what they would like the Joint Standing Committee on Defence to know. And greetings to the Chair, greetings to the members, and greetings to the Minister of Defence. Thank you. Deputy Minister, thank you.
Thank you very much, SG. This is an important aspect, especially that it takes care of our soldiers on when they are on retirement, and that we must continue to look after their health. So the fund must challenges, and unless the challenges are matters beyond the control of the fund, and it's part welfare of our own soldiers who have contributed all their life in the defense of our country. And acknowledging that, I now welcome the Surgeon General to take us through the presentation. Over to you, Surgeon General.
Good evening, Chairperson, Mr. Gaba. Let me acknowledge the Deputy Minister of Defense, Mr. Thabang Makwetsa, the sector. I think the Chief of Staff has joined us. Now, the presentation will be made by the principal officer who is responsible for the day-to-day managing of this fund. I am, as the Surgeon General, the chairperson of the board that runs this fund. As the SecDef has indicated, this fund is supposed to provide care for our retired members of the Defence Force. And again, let me emphasize what the SecDef has indicated, that members of the Defence Force contribute towards this fund during their time in employment, so that the fund will buy medical services. When it was established, this fund was meant to buy medical services solely from the South African Military Health Services. That is, it was meant to receive full cover by paying a very nominal fee to the South African Military Health Services. So in this regard, let me stress that this is a private fund, and it's an autonomous body that is supposed to be run privately by a board that is elected after a specified period. However, its establishment is based on the Defence Act. There are medical regulations that regulate this fund. So, Honourable Chairperson, if you will allow me, I will hand over to Dr. Achary, the principal officer of the fund, who is also a member of the board, to make the presentation for us. If you allow, I will call on Dr. Jamuna, my apologies, Dr. Jamuna, to make the presentation for us. Dr. Jamuna?
Dr. Jamuna is the principal of the fund, or he is presenting on behalf of the principal of the fund?
She is the principal officer of the fund.
Oh, principal officer of the fund. Okay, that's fine. Dr. Jamuna, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Surgeon General. Good evening to everybody, acknowledging the Deputy Minister of Defence, SecDef, and members of the Standing Committee on Defence, all protocol observed. Thank you for affording us the opportunity for being here this evening to really provide a status on a really very important entity within the broader aspect of the DoD. And I think, as the SecDef alluded to and the Surgeon General, this is a very important fund. We have to ensure that we take care of our soldiers post-retirement. And that really is the essence of it all. So allow me to indulge you for a few minutes so that we can provide the status report to you. So just a brief introduction, a bit of background, and just to provide a little bit of a turnaround strategy, because there was a bit of a crisis with the fund. I will share some financials and provide the actuarial report that allows us to make decisions. There's some important successes that we've managed to achieve. There are obviously challenges and, of course, more importantly, the fund's sustainability. And, of course, a brief conclusion. So the fund, as the SG alluded to, is an autonomous structure that was established around 1964 for retired regular force members to receive continued health care benefits once they had retired. So the fund is not a typical medical scheme or medical aid fund. It's a medical pension type fund. And of course, it cannot be compared to other funds of the SANDF, and it does not function like a committee in the SANDF. And think, as SG has mentioned, it is an autonomous fund. There is a board of trustees who have their fiduciary duties towards the fund. And the fundamental aim is to ensure the fund's sustainability through managed health care. So the board around 2016 until 2016 comprised of SANDF members, that is sort of senior officers, trustees, retired, and union representation. And during this time, unfortunately, the challenges within the fund that were highlighted in the annual audited financial statements as well as the actuarial reports seem not to have been addressed. And with that, there arose this financial and management crisis that had developed by 2016. By January 2017, the board was dissolved by the Military Command Council as, you know, an important stakeholder to the fund. There was an interim board that was appointed by the minister, which was established as an intervention to manage and address the crisis. And the trustees, composed of SANDF members and a few private sector members, chaired by the Surgeon General. The new permanent board was only established this year in May, and so there is full representation as per the general regulations. The key stakeholders in terms of the way the fund operates is that the fund is managed by the Board of Trustees, and SAMS, the Military Health Services, really are the primary designated service provider. And all of this is regulated and governed by the general regulations, which is part of the Defence Act, and it gives effect to what the fund is, how it needs to be managed, what it's supposed to do, and how it goes about doing its business. And because of the nature of the fund and how it has evolved over a period of time in terms of managed health care, it was necessary to have professional healthcare administrators So the fund's healthcare administrators is PPSHA, which is the Professional Providence Society Healthcare Administrator. Along with the administrator that takes care of the managed administration, there are third parties that the fund has engaged with to allow certain specialized areas to be attended to. For example, the optometry benefits, OptiClear is an entity that allows us to ensure proper services. Then we have MediCredit, which takes care of the pharmacy management aspects. And along with the other general healthcare providers in the private health sector, which is your hospital groups, your private GPs and specialists and all of those providers. So as a snapshot, the RFMCF portfolio is made up of principal members, 19,345 members, and these were members that had to have been contributing to this fund whilst they were in active service. They would have contributed on a monthly amount that comes directly into the fund. The total number of lives covered by the fund is 32,827. So these principal members, some of them who are alone as the main member, then there are those who have dependents, whether it's spouses, partners, children. So the total lives is this 32,000 members. The 57,841 active force members are the members that are contributing to the fund. So they would pay their monthly contributions, and those funds are paid towards the fund. The claims ratio, again, just a snapshot for you to understand, that this is determined by the income, which I've just alluded to from the active force members. There are a small portion of the 19,000 members that would pay, and they would be those who would have gone on early retirement. So one of the rules of the fund is you must have contributed until you are 60 years of age to enjoy benefits from the fund. So along with the active force members, there are about 5,000 members who would have gone on early retirement, like many taking the MEM recently, would be some of the contributing members. So the income less the expenditure is what the claims ratio is all about. And the moment it crosses over 100%, ideally it should be around 85%. The moment it crosses over 100%, that is indicative that the expenses are greater than the income. Okay? And of course, that is quite a challenge for the fund at this stage. Further to this, to add, the active force contributing members have not had an increase since 2019 towards the fund. Even though the Board of Trustees that has its fiduciary duty towards the fund made and took those decisions, they were not implemented in the SANDF. Further to that, in the last 2 years, the unions were very active in bringing interdicts against these increases. So the fund has had a R0 increase from the active force members for 5 years, and yet our expenses annually have continued to rise. And medical inflation is far higher than your general inflation, and this is consistently increasing. And along with this, the fact that the medical healthcare industry relies heavily on imported equipment, consumables, all of that depending on the rand-dollar exchange can only be imagined as to the increased costs of healthcare. So when that crisis had taken place with the interim board coming in, the focus areas was really about improved governance because there was a gap there, the improved management, which was both administration and the operational side things with the financial. And of course, improving on our relationships, in particular, our main stakeholders, the SANDF, that's SAMS and the rest of the other structures, in particular Chief HR, and of course our membership with members, okay? Because a lot of them have stopped contributing post 60, there seem to have been this kind of distance that they had in terms of how the fund had to engage with these members. We also have monitored and made a big improvement in terms of the interventions with managed healthcare, with proper, very prudent financial management, and of course, very intense internal audit functions. And along with these interventions, there's been a lot of improvement and streamlining. But of course, there's only so much you can do in terms of management expertise. The current funding model, and it's important to understand this whole funding model, because this has really started a long time ago, and unfortunately the funding model did not improve or align itself as the Defence Force evolved through the whole post-1994 period, with the change in employment conditions for members, but the funding model has just remained the same. So it works on a pre-funding model that whilst you are in active force, you contribute towards this fund, just sort of exactly like a pension fund. And that is why I mentioned it's a pension medical fund type model. And this was established within the DoD, and finance along with Chief HR and legal, we feel has to strongly review the current model to also define its juristic status in terms of contributions. Because a lot of the employment contracts and benefits have changed, but the funds model remains the same. Another important aspect is it's a closed fund because it's only restricted to active force members who have contributed to the fund. There's also other criteria in terms of becoming a member of the fund. And the point of entry really is age. So when the member has to enter the Defence Force, it is the age of entry that determines what amount they should pay. And of course, that is done within the HR environment. There's also the contribution criteria as to how this has to take place. Obviously, if members join the Defence Force at a very late age, their amounts will be much higher. If they had started very early and at a very young age, their amounts will be a little bit less. And these are only for military pensioners, as I said, in terms of how they would qualify. So there are criteria. You must have contributed for 10 years only in circumstances such as death or medical wards can a member less than 10 years become a member of the funds, which means they would have to buy back that age until 60 to belong to the fund. So the rank and the salary does not determine the contribution. As said, it's only the age of entry that determines this when the member enters the fund. So this is really the financial status, the situation of the fund. So, you know, this is just a little graph that clearly depicts what really happened. So around 2015, the fund, with its assets, was sitting around, you know, 1.1 billion. And as I mentioned, with some of the challenges that the fund experienced in terms of management, along with contribution, low contributions, you know, it really plummeted. And around 2018 was left with 358 million rand. And that was when a lot of the interventions, the new strategies were beginning to be implemented. And there was a slow growth over that period. And as at the end of 2022, our audited financial statements, we started to show around 1.01 billion again. So it's been quite a painful and quite an arduous process to try and get the fund back to where it would need to be. So again, this is just to give a snapshot of what the financials are all about. So on the financial year ending, you know, from 2015, right up until current 2023, we can see the monthly contributions have slowly been increased, because in 2018 we did put in, because it really was like a crisis that we had to institute quite.
The borrower from Henry.
Just poor management that was taking place at that time. And then there started to be an increase in terms of the surplus. And then again, last year, the outsourcing started to increase again. And then also at the beginning of this year, we also with the MIM had more members entering into the as members. So the number of claiming lives started to increase as well. So this was at our close of financials this year, the 1.5 million loss. So this also just tells you about the claims ratio, as I said, income versus expenditure. And you can see from 2015, it was huge. It just kept on increasing. And then with the interventions, we managed to decrease it until late last year. And then, of course, it started to take an upturn with the amount of claiming lives and the increased outsourcing. So just to, again, understand the contributions, you know, both the sector and SG mentioned, you know, there is an amount that members pay, which is not a very large amount. So the split code is the code that is used to determine the age of a member. So there's got over 60 odd split codes that HR has, and they all depend on the age of entry of a member into the force. So we've just roughly given an example here that for split code 58, a member entered in 2017 and they would leave around 2025. Their contribution amount is around 2,000 rand per month because of the late entry that they made into the force. However, when they leave, they would have only contributed an amount of 210,000 rand into the kitty. Okay? The next one, split code 56, member joined in 2019. They would leave by 2024. They only would have contributed 202,000 rand into the kitty. The next member, split code 30, they would have joined in 2012. And they would have left this year, they would have only contributed 99,000 rand, 800, not even 100,000. A member who joined in 1985, who would leave at the age, retire in 2025, would have paid 324,480. That's the total amount they would have paid. With the increased outsourcing, we have only one hospital event these days costing nothing less than 200,000 to 300,000 rand, one hospital event. We have had a few cases, and it's not unusual to get a hospital bill of members around 3 million, 4 million. This year we had a member of a 5 million hospital rand, a hospital bill. And they would have only paid these few 100,000 rand. Apart from a hospital event, remember, members would be afforded pharmacy, all their medication, day-to-day visits, whether it's physiotherapy, you know, the psychological services, if they need dialysis, if they, all of these x-rays, your blood, all of that are, again, all huge amounts. And because members are also living in areas where there's no access to military health facilities, these costs would continue to escalate. So between members living in far-off areas and that the SAMS, in terms of its capability, is not able to provide services, the fund actually becomes a victim to the Defence Force in terms of what it has to pay. So the actuarial report, the fund has its actuaries that have to annually provide a valuation to the fund as per the rules and regulations, and for our audited financial statements, these things are required. And for many years, they have been warning the board of its increased risk and its potential sustainability. So our current valuation, completed as of March 2023, shows that the fund's liability from 2019 to 2023 has increased from 8.4 billion rand to 18.8 billion. This shows that the fund is only 6.83% funded. That means we are 93-odd% underfunded. And no fund should be anything less than 100%. So we are, you know, really an underfunded fund. Technically speaking, we can be regarded as bankrupt. The fact that we have assets, cash in bank, and assets that we can liquidate, gives us that ability to be cash flush. And further to this, the National Treasury wants to introduce a new payment fee that the fund has to pay to the SANS. So currently, these retired members, when they do visit a military facility, there's no free service. There is a nominal amount every time a member visits the sick bay or visits a dental clinic or collects medication or is in hospital at any SAMS facility. The fund pays the SAMS for that. Now, Treasury is asking SAMS that they should increase this amount. And, you know, the actuaries, of course, did the modeling. And this would be an additional 30% to the current 14 million. Currently, our expenses for the month are around 47 million, and our income is on average 47 million. So it would mean our expenses with these type of expenditure would be around 62 million, which would obviously make it unsustainable to the fund. So, you know, really the extent of the outsourcing cannot warrant such tariffs. And, you know, we are always concerned as to who will carry the liability for the fund, as there's been no contribution increases from the SANDF for members for the past 5 years. So just coming to the successes, within all of these challenges, we really managed to do some great work and to have some successes as well. The governance, our really prudent financial management, and our member communication, so that we could start to engage and educate members that that they really need to act more responsibly. You know, those of you here who may be in the military may understand that there's this notion and culture of, you know, I'm getting it for free, so I can almost kind of abuse it, you know. So that culture seems to linger on when members kind of move over to the retirement fund environment. And we're trying to educate members that they have to be able to use and be responsible how they have access to their benefits in terms of healthcare. So there's a lot of work being done there. We have a very strong internal audit intervention team that has been involved in fraud investigations. And we've currently got a few cases in terms of, you know, private providers and, of course, members within the military. And these are being attended to. We have not not investigated these. We have taken these through to the full spectrum, so that these individuals can be dealt with in terms of the law. We've made a lot of technology improvements. Unfortunately, again, the lack of a postal service, an efficient postal service, the fact that we've got to communicate with members who are scattered all over the country, not only in close proximity to a military facility. So, you know, we've had to have technology improvements. We have a new online application, which makes it simple for members, so that when they do become a member, they don't have challenges like previously, that they've left the force and they're still waiting for a few months to have their membership benefits implemented. Now it's done really very quickly. And of course, we've also implemented what we call a schedule of benefits so that members can now have a basket of benefits to start to take care of and look after responsibly. It's not that anybody is being denied healthcare, but their processes that when you exhaust those benefits, then you start to, you know, we help you ensure that you would get your exemption benefits attended to. The fund is not there to prevent anybody from receiving healthcare, but to ensure quality and appropriate care is provided for members. So some of the challenges in sustainability that we do have, you know, just almost in summary again, that the causes of the financial depletion is the low contributions model. As mentioned, the fund and members are working and receiving benefits in the private healthcare space. And the cost of healthcare, you know, the fund has to meet these challenges. And the problem is the fact that the healthcare environment, unfortunately, is no longer regulated. You know, up until 2003, tariffs, there was a kind of a regulation that has since been changed and done away with, which means, you know, a healthcare provider can charge whatever they want. And you then are kind of obliged to pay that. And that is why this fund has engaged on trying to negotiate, you know, tariffs and services to make sure that we are paying for appropriate care. Membership challenges, you know, I mentioned that contracts have changed. Post-1994, we don't have members coming in at the age of 18 and leaving at the age of 60, whereby this model may have served a purpose for that nature of employment. But it's no longer that way. Now we have short-term employment contracts, we have medium-term contracts, we have MSDs coming to the system. So we haven't aligned all of these things to the regulations. And that is obviously an area for great work from Chief HR. The other big area is the fact that the DoD does not work on a life system. So things like divorces, members are divorced, they've incurred huge medical bills, and we've got to find ways of how you start to recover those costs. And just generally the high expenditure that has been taking place. So what we call our increased cost of our liabilities, which is largely the SAM's challenges, and I have to say at the outset, it's not SAMs per se, but SAMs operates within the DoD, within the SANDF environment. So whatever's taking place within the SANDF, SAMs, again, is subject to that. So the fact that facilities and things are not up to speed, the fact that Chief HR is not having appointments done in time, the fact that the log and the procurement processes are not up to speed. So the increased use of the private sector is continuing and it's increasing. And because that is increasing, the fund has to pay more and more and more as more of our members, the retired members, have to use the private healthcare services. So there are problems with inadequate control and monitoring systems. You know, these days you need very up-to-date IT systems and processes and, you know, that kind of capability. And unfortunately, some of these are archaic in the DoD. The fact that there's open-ended benefits, you know, while some of the regulations and policies do talk of how things need to be controlled, but because they're not very specific, members on the ground fail to take on the responsibility to be quite strict about certain things. So then there's this culture of members believing that they can get whatever they want. And I think worse off is where the private health sector have really abused the system in terms of how they've been charging the SANDF. So the fund, again, you know, is a recipient of that until we started putting in the controls from our side, because we have the authority, we can do that. we've been managed, you know, in terms of tariffs, et cetera, we've managed to do all of that. We also find that the SAMHSA healthcare practitioners, and I think everybody needs to understand SAMHSA is there to provide a healthcare service. There's doctors, there's nurses, there's healthcare providers to provide that medical service. They are not there in terms of having to do this managed healthcare, to do medical administration, et cetera, et cetera. So now with the change in the last few years because of resource constraints within the SAMHSA DoD as a whole, the SAMHSA now has to provide services. It has to start to try and do medical healthcare, managed healthcare, and medical administration, of which it doesn't have the capacity, the capabilities, the systems, and the resources. So, you know, and that's where the fund becomes, you know, unfortunately a victim to all of this. And I spoke about the whole DoD as a whole, because it's not just about SAMHSA per se, but, you know, whether it's LOG, it's HR, it's, you know, all the refurbishments and the procurement and all these providers, unfortunately, impact on the SAMHSA. And then what goes on in the SAMHSA is now impacting on what happens, is happening in the RFNCF. So in conclusion, you know, just to highlight some of the priorities for the management of the fund and the trustees, is that the prudent financial management has to continue because the fund remains less than 10% funded. The whole funding model is something that we're trying to work with HR, and something that is being considered, where the board has also discussed this, is the aspect where the employer, you know, the possibility of the employer making a contribution to members for their medical benefits. You know, the way your other government departments in terms of their medical benefit contributions are kind of subsidized or part is carried by the department. The same kind of model needs to be considered. You know, in some of the earlier discussions, that possibility was discussed, except the difference here was you can't get a contribution because you're getting a benefit in kind, which means SAMHSA is providing the medical service at a low cost. However, that service continues to deplete. So this kind that the fund is dependent on the defense force is getting less and less and less. And whether now the employer needs to step up and to see whether there needs to be some kind of contribution, kind of subsidization to the members for when they retire. The general regulations and the amendment of HR policies are critical. The general regulations are quite, again, archaic in terms of what it was set out for. There's so many changes that have taken place, and we need to ensure that the regulations are up to speed. Just as an example, I mentioned the fund is not a registered medical aid. However, the Council for Medical Schemes is harassing us because we are in the business. We are doing the business of a medical fund, so we should apply to be registered. The argument we are using is that one of the fellow departments, State Security, they have their own medical aid and it's run as a proper medical aid, except in their act, in the National Intelligence Act, it clearly stipulates that their medical aid is exempt from registering with the Council of Medical Schemes. So those are the kind of things we want our regulations and Defence Act to start to reflect. So it starts to protect our members, because it is very onerous if we had to be registered as a medical aid. Okay? The fact that we now have a permanent board, however, there are conflict of interest issues. You know, the chair of the board, the SG, would be the first to announce his conflict. But it's not just about him. We now have the unions on board. We believe it's a serious conflict because their interest is in the active force members, not for the retired members. Okay? We also have other active force members, senior officers, but they're not always clear that they are sitting on the board in the interest of the members of the fund, not their active force members who are in the Army, the Air Force, or the Navy. So these are grey areas, and we hope to iron these out. We really wish for the SAM's intervention on the challenges that are impacting the fund. But again, it's not SAM's alone. The DoD as a whole has to assist and ensure that SAMS is able to provide more services in-house. You know, it has more resources in terms of people, equipment, facilities, et cetera, et cetera. And that then would reduce the way the outsourcing and how much we may need to pay in the fund for all these private services. We currently have quite a few risks. We've got a risk register in the fund, but again, a lot of those risks are external to the fund. You know, the environment within which we're functioning are creating all these risks. So we're obviously trying to mitigate all of that and would like to change the risk profile of the fund. We are improving our stakeholder engagement. One of the areas that we're really trying to break through is to work with the active force members, obviously through Chief HR, because they need to understand the value of what this fund is. They need to understand why annually there needs to be these increases. They need to see the bigger picture that when they do, you know, one day retire, the importance and the value of having healthcare benefits, you know, in their older times. And of course, with the beneficiaries, our beneficiaries, as the VPA members themselves, the retired members, there's lots of engagement and it's going very well with members. So really, in short, this is what I have to say. And in conclusion, that the sustainability of the regular force medical continuation fund is totally dependent on the status of the SANDF and the professional management of the fund. Thank you. And I'm happy to take questions. SG, we can do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jampner. Chairperson, this is our presentation. We will be ready to engage in discussion.
Thank you very much. I can see the risk, and that if it is not mitigated, the members will suffer, as they would not have medical cover unless they are able to fund it from their own pockets. But it starts with them. Contributing into the fund and making it sustainable, even when they are no longer in active service. We are saying it's the fund is predicated on the amount that you contribute now, and I suppose that the money you contribute now also subsidizes those who are no longer in active service, and that if members don't consider the issue that the fund must be sustainable, the active members don't consider that the fund must be sustainable, they prejudice those who are no longer in themselves, and worse, those who are no longer in active service. With them, they can still possibly subsidize it from their own pocket because they are still in active service, they are receiving a salary. But for those who are no longer in active service, who are not possibly receiving pension, that it's close to nothing, are now faced with exorbitant medical costs.
And those who are not in active reserves demand, in fact, the cost of providing medical care to them is much more, way more expensive than the cost of providing medical care to those who are in active service. So it's critical that this balance is maintained so that the fund is able to look after you now and when you are in retirement. I foresee the fund collapsing if these matters that are being put on the table now are not attended to. And I really want to commend the fund that even when it dropped, its financial situation dropped from 1 billion rand at some point in 2015 to about 358 million rand in 2018, but they were able to recover. They are now sitting at a billion rand. But a billion rand in 2015 and a billion rand in 2023, you can see that we're not talking a significant improvement in that regard, but at least it's something. It shows some improvement in the fund. But that it's dropped below, we are now at 100% when you ought to be at 85% in terms of ratio, then is really a cause for concern. And my last point on this is that sums the it's in terms of our own hospitals. Remember, SAMS is like an insurance. That's the reason why you have this fund. SAMS is an insurance for both serving and retired soldiers. And that if this insurance is not working well, this insurance it's faces exhibits some serious challenges and they are not addressed. It means that we'll have to rely on a private sector. Some will be forced to outsource, and the outsourcing of services comes at great cost, and those costs must come out of this fund. And this fund, its contribution has not been increasing for the past 5 years. That they took the decision not to increase the contributions when the costs increase every year, in some cases more than the inflationary rate, it fails me. But colleagues, the matter is up on the table for discussion. I thought I should just make my own comment. The Surgeon General and Doctor and the principal officer may want to comment maybe when it comes to when I offer them time to make their own comment. I now open it up. I'll start with my colleague, the co-chair, Honorable Chabeleng, go to Mr. Mare, and then take Mr. Malaka Shelembe. Honorable co-chair, over to you.
Thanks a lot, Chair, and the members on the platform. I got cut out of the presentation for some time, but I just want to check that is the how ready is the medical is the insurance fund for the with the developments that are happening within the country, particularly the national insurance funds. Have they thought about how will they fit into the scheme if it succeeds, and then how do they see advantages, and I mean how will it help them going forward? That's what I just wanted to say, because in terms of the presentation I didn't hear a lot. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and Honorable Marin.
Thank you, Chair. My apologies that I joined a bit late, but thank you very much for the presentation, Doctor. It obviously gives us a picture that is concerning, but it's also some realities that we must face. I think we must start off by asking, well, what is the overall purpose of this fund? You have talked over a lot of presentation pages about things that you are facing, that challenges, that, you know, all of these things. At the end, it is about the members. If you can't serve the members, then this fund has got no justification. And when you look at the members that must be, you know, get the benefit from the fund, then you must also go and see, especially in terms of the retirees, to say that what was the contract between the Defence Force and those retirees at the time when they were members of the fund and when they contributed on a monthly basis. If the agreement was that, listen, this is an open book, and we might increase or decrease the benefits to a level where you will have to contribute yourself or pay co-payments yourself, then obviously that is part of the contract. But if it was part of the contract that after they retire, they will have medical insurance and medical benefits, then you and us have got an obligation to make sure that those retirees are provided the medical service that they require, whether it is by a state hospital, whether it is by the SAMS, or whether it is via the private sector. That's not their problem. So one must look at that whole thing, and I'm a bit concerned that most of the complaints that we receive is because of co-payments that they have to make, which they cannot afford. And the chairperson has referred to the pension of retired soldiers are not that high. Not all of them were 3, 4, and 4-star generals. Some of them were non-commissioned officers, were corporals, sergeants, and they've got a family and they are retired now. So we have got an obligation towards them in terms of their initial contract with the Defence Force. So all of the others, we will have to agree that somehow the money must be found to make sure that we stick to the agreement with them. Doesn't matter where the money is going to come from, we have got an obligation. When you talk about the funding of this fund, in other words, where's the money coming from? I cannot understand why there's been a 0% increase in premiums. And it seems like, I'm not quite sure whether there was legal actions. You talk about unions. I think there's only one union, and that's Sandu. And that's only for the last few years that Sandu is there. This problem seems to be coming on for quite some time. So how has this problem occurred and now blaming unions? I find that very difficult to understand. We as members of parliament, whether we get an increase of salary in a year or not, we've got a yearly increase in our closed fund as well, called BARMED. And we have got no option. Whether it is above the inflation, whether it is more than we get in an increased salary increase, and whether we get an increase or not. So I cannot understand why that has occurred and how that has been allowed to go on. You're mentioning about the huge cost of private sector. Now, yes, some of them are very, very far in South Africa, but that's a reality that we've always known since wherever. So you can't prescribe to them in their employment contract when you retire, it must be close to a medical hospital or a military hospital. So that's not an argument. What I do not understand is when we look at the Department of Defense budget, we have always said SAMS is one of the biggest expense items. And one reason for that
is the cost of outsourcing. Now, if they have got the cost of outsourcing and you complain about the same cost, who's carrying the cost of outsourcing? Is it the medical fund or is it SAMHSA? I mean, it cannot be on both sides. So I'm not quite sure how that fits into each other. When you talk about the schedule, that you're going to draw up a schedule, yes, I mean, we've also got a schedule, but we have got an agreement in terms of how that schedule look and what is the limits. You must just consider whether it is fair at this stage to change benefits and the schedule of benefits, and you do not give extra money in the hands of those retirees to be able to afford that. Otherwise, it's only the fund that will win, and it is a total loss for the members. We get consistent complaints, and I sit with one in front of me, and I know that it's been addressed to Dr. Jumana as well, where people talk about accounts that do not get paid, or it is so late payments that the doctors are refusing follow-up service because they say they don't get the payment or they don't get the full payment from you. How do we address that? And you say it's going very well with your members and your communication with the members. So what do we do with those cases that we receive, and we have discussed it in the committee in the past as well? That's why we have got this presentation tonight. What do we do with that? Because that indicates to the contrary. I want to ask you, in terms of your board of trustees, I assume there are representatives from active members and that there are representatives from retired members. Because that's only fair. You deal with the benefits and the lives of those people. If you do not have active members, representatives, and retirees, do you think that is fair? And how can that be rectified? And if you do have some of the representative of both those two groups, how are they elected? Or how does it happen that they then serve on the board of trustees on behalf of those members? Chairperson, then my last one. Oh, you've talked about that the fund is nearly bankrupt. But that's not the definition of insolvency. Insolvency is when you are insolvent, you will take all your cash and all your properties and all your assets, and you will liquidate that, and you will not be able to fund your obligations. If that's not the case, then you are not insolvent. You might have a liquidity problem, but it also doesn't seem like you've got a liquidity problem, but you've got maybe a sustainable problem going into the next 10 years. So one must just get that right as well. Then, Chairperson, I think that is basically for me at this stage, because it's either contributions from the members, or it is co-payments from the Department of Defense, which must form part of the cost of employees and the salary negotiations on a yearly basis at the bargaining council. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. And Honorable Shelembe. I also saw the head of Honorable Mafanya. So after Shelembe, it will be Mafanya, Honorable Mafanya. Okay. What is Shelembe?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And also the presentation that is putting the good picture of what is happening there in the regular force medical continuation fund, which I think we all agree it's a very, very good, I mean, program that is looking at our soldiers, as we all agree that, I mean, the work they are doing for dedicating themselves, we also need, I mean, to take care of them. Well, I think Mr. Murray, I mean, has covered, I mean, a lot, and some I'll be like, I mean, concurring with him. But one of the issues I think he has touched on is the issue where they say the claims are more than, I mean, the income that they are getting, and which makes it difficult and result in having the fund getting bankrupt. Now, Chair, I understand that some of the issues and challenges is that the unions seems not, I mean, to be agreeing when they sort of like maybe increase so that they are able to maintain the fund. Now, my question, Chair, is that maybe if I can be furnished with a good reason from the unions as to why there should be no increase, considering that, I mean, it is not that is that they don't, I mean, to assist them, but because of the inflation, they have to consider an increase. Maybe just maybe to get maybe if when they are discussing, maybe their good reasons and what are their proposal, what are they saying in, so that, I mean, that issue of not, I mean, balancing the two is addressed. And two, I'm checking, Chairperson, to say one of the challenges, some of the challenges, you know, are like the number of spouses. Like, I'm checking now, what happens, how do they define the spouse? Is it someone that you are married, or is just, I mean, anyone that you are having an affair? Because now, if they say due to number of spouses, and this is costing the fund, I would appreciate maybe the clarity or the definition of the spouse as concern. Then, Chair, also, I was looking, I mean, at just maybe to find out, since the board is in place or the time it was established, if there were any reported fraud and corruption in this board, if they were, maybe if they can further give us investigation, I would appreciate that, because I heard that maybe since now they are like, I mean, having some sort of internal audit committee looking at the fraud and corruption. That is all for now, Chair. I think, No, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Honourable Mafanya.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. At this point, I've got a couple of questions. I would like to know whether members join voluntarily, or is it a compulsory fund, since I see that it started as far as back as 1964. And the other part is that you claim not to have been registered with the medical fund. And noting that the RFMCF is a private entity, which has got perhaps, maybe, I don't know, a contractual obligation with the force. Those sorts of agreements, we need to understand what were the terms of reference when you had to go into this venture of assisting the medical fraternity in the Defense Force. Because what we know is that SEMS is the one responsible, and that is the one that is getting budgets in the department. And we account to SEMS. Now, the presentation makes me question, why are we to listen to you number one, because you don't account to us as a private entity. In as much as you are dealing with it might be an opportunity that this company has seen that you can assist the defense, but in reality, you don't account to us. We cannot even come and peruse your books to know what is happening there. And there is this thing that you say you are being underfunded. By who? Does the Department of Defense fund the project itself, or because of the money that you get from the soldiers, that's not sufficient? So I'm looking at those scenarios to say, we have you not as a registered medical fund, number one. Number two, there are already people, almost 19,000. And whether it is compulsory, because we've got more than 19,000 members in the Defense Force. So if it's voluntarily, how did you go about it? Whether you are administrators of this fund, is the monies, are they insured? Are the monies insured? Normally is that when administrators take the money from recipients, whoever that is, the money must be insured. So that should there be anything that goes haywire, the risk is not on you. So I want to clarify me on those. So that the other part is that you said you refer some of patients to SAMHS. Now, SAMHS as our own entity, we know the conditions and the status of SAMHS. And when you refer our soldiers to SAMHS, for heaven's sake, and then they get treatment, then who pays that? Do you pay SAMHS, or do they fall within the scope that we are all used to? That SAMHS is its obligation because it gets funding from the state. So those are some of the questions that I wanted to highlight in terms of what I see here. Then can I get clarity on those? Thanks.
Thank you very much. I have three more hands, but let's take a pause and request both SAMHS as well as the fund to answer the questions or make comments before I take further hands.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. This is the Surgeon General. Myself and the principal officer will try and answer the questions. I'm not so sure if there are other board members who are here who can assist where I may not cover. Firstly, with Mr. Honorable Chabeleng, the question was about the National Health Insurance. How the National Health Insurance will relate to this fund, and whether we have considered the National Health Insurance as the same. Now, the provisions of the National Health Insurance, or at the moment, the National Health Insurance says that the members of the Defense Force, that is active members of the Defense Force, will not be part of the National Health Insurance. We are currently still in discussion with the Department of Health in terms of what does that mean? Does that mean that members of the Defense Force will not contribute towards the National Health Insurance? And if so, how are the members of the Defense Force, or the retired members of the Defense Force, how will they benefit from the insurance, the National Health Insurance Fund? However, we're also, as the SAMHS, exploring ways that if the SAMHS meets the national health standards, may be able to provide the services to the National Health Insurance Fund, to the National Health Insurance, and be able to generate some funds. Now, you will understand that can only happen if the SAMHS meets the national health standards, because there are national health standards that must be met for a facility to partake in the National Health Insurance. We are currently in discussion with the Department of Health. But what I can say now is at this moment, members of the Defence Force, I'm talking about active, not retired, will not be included as part of the National Health Insurance. But then when you go further, it does not indicate whether they will be excluded in terms of contributing towards this. As you know, that National Treasury is exploring, together with the Department of Health, ways that this National Health Insurance will be funded. So that I will leave it at that at the moment. Then Honorable Mare, is quite a mouthful. I hope I will be able to address all the questions, but my colleagues will assist me where I can. I may not. The purpose of the fund, as we stated earlier, is to provide health care for the retired members of the Defence Force. That is the sole purpose of this fund. And when it was established, this fund was to get services from the SENS. In other words, the SENS was supposed to provide 100% care for members of the retired members of the Defence Force. And therefore, the expenditure that the fund is experiencing at this stage was not envisaged. So when a member of the retired members of the regular continuation fund goes to the SENS, they were supposed to pay a nominal fee. At the moment, during the presentation, Dr. Jamuna indicated that Treasury is considering to increase the contribution that this fund should pay to the SENS when they visit the SENS for services. At the moment, for each and every service that the SENS provides, this fund is supposed to pay 15 rands. It has been like that for years. It has not changed. And that's why Treasury feels that no, the service, the healthcare is now expensive. We must increase the contribution that the fund must pay to the SENS. But however, you all know the SENS has come here and presented the challenges that it faces, and that's why the outsourcing, and that's why the fund is not copy. Now, Mr. Honorable Mare indicated that there are complaints from members complaining about co-payment. There is no co-payment that the members are supposed to pay. However, as part of managed health care, the board, as well as the administrator, have gone out there, which is what all the medical aid schemes do, go out there and negotiate it with certain healthcare providers, they be designated second service providers, and charge a fee that will be agreed between the fund and those providers. And the availability of this designated service provider has been distributed to all the members of the fund. Now, if a member goes and visits a healthcare provider who is not a designated, Dr. Jamuna did indicate that the charges of the healthcare providers were not regulated. She indicated that some form of regulation was introduced this year. But all along, they will pay whatever they want. So if you go to two doctors, let's say Dr. Mapa and Jamuna, and Dr. Mapa is a member of the designated health providers, will charge the fees that were agreed with the regular continuation fund. And then you go to Dr. Jamuna. By the way, this is just an example, who is not a designated service provider and can charge whatever they want. And that member goes to that non-designated service provider without authority, then they will have to pay the difference. So in general, there is no co-payment that a member is required to pay, provided they go to the designated service provider. Then Honorable Mare spoke about funding in terms of where the funding is coming from. Well, we did indicate that members of the active members of the Defence Force contribute towards this fund whilst they are employed. When they retire, that money that they contributed becomes the fund that will contribute towards this. Now, I'm saying to you here that there is no provision from the government to provide the services of the retired members of the Defence Force when they retire. That's why this fund was formed in 1964 to cover them. Now, the contractual agreement that the government has with members of the saving defense, members of the Defence Force who are active, is that the government will provide that member with 100% care, with that member not paying a cent. And that is what is happening now. But that provision does not extend to the retired members. And that's why the formation of this fund. And then you ask why there is no increase in contribution. We did indicate that this fund was found to be going through financial challenges, I think in around 2015, because over the years, the fund was completely relying on the fence. And therefore, the fence, up until 2010, you may know that in our presentation in the status of the fence, we indicated that since 2010, the fence started outsourcing. And that started here in Pretoria, specifically with 1 mil when the refurbishment started. And over the years, we have presented to this committee the challenges that the fence is facing in terms of the facilities, in terms of medical equipment, in terms of human resources, that the fence, as the years go, is unable to provide the care that is required. And therefore, we end up outsourcing, and outsourcing is expensive. Now, with the lack of funding, it came to a stage where the fence may not be able to pay all the monies that are owed to the service providers. And the board that was then decided that the fund will pay for itself. And that's why the fund suffered financial crisis during those years. And when the interim board was appointed, they implemented certain measures, and one of them was managed healthcare. Managed healthcare, it means when a patient has been seen by a service provider and an invoice is sent to you, you scrutinize in terms of whether the invoice is what was provided to the member. Now, for you to be able to do that, you should be monitoring that patient's stay. If the patient is admitted in a hospital, you need to have access to that patient and be able to manage and approve any concomitant care that is required for that patient. And all along, that has not been happening. Now, with the introduction of more administrative measures, one of them being managed health care, another one being designated service providers, the interim board was able to cut the expenditure. If you check, the expenditure did go down from around 2018 until it started going up again. And it's going up again because now the membership of the retired has increased. And Dr. Damuna, it did indicate that with the MEM and the retiring, the number of claimants increased, whilst the contribution is not increasing. In the same vein, if you check in 2018, there was an increase in contribution. And that's why you realize that the fund surplus funds started increasing. It's because there was a massive increase after the interim board had indicated that if we do not increase the contribution of the member, this fund would have ceased to exist, I think, probably in 2019. But through the intervention of the interim board, that changed and it started getting better. But however, the expense of medical care is increasing. Dr. Jamuna again indicated that that was the only increase that was introduced. And for the past 5 years, it's not happening. It's not happening, not because the board did not recommend this. The board did recommend. However, with the union, he indicated that they've got their own interests, and their interests are the active members in terms of their salary. They may not be, I don't want to say they don't have the foresight to see that this fund is very important for these members when they retire. However, their interest is on their active saving members, and their interest is on what these people get in their pockets, not what it will mean for them when they retire without a medical aid. So for the past 5 years, there is no increment. while the inflation of medical care is increasing. That's why if you look at the financial status, it will show you that now the ratios are starting to tilt towards a more expenditure than contribution. You indicated that the stance is the biggest expender of the FNDF budget. I'm not so sure which budget the Honorable Marae is looking at. But however, the budget that the FEMS is getting at the moment is not in line with healthcare expense, as well as in terms of ensuring that the FEMS is having facilities that are reliable, is having equipment that is reliable, is able to sustain and retain healthcare professionals. So I do not agree with the Honorable Marae that the FEMS is the biggest spender of the FNDF budget. And then again, this one of complaints that the members are complaining that their accounts are not being paid. I think I did explain that when I spoke about the co-payments. And then you ask about the board, who are the members of this board? This board is composed, I'm talking about the permanent one that the minister appointed this year, is composed of active force members who are appointed by the services themselves. In other words, in this board, there are members from defense, there are members from the army, the air force, the navy, who are members of this board, as well as the legal representation who comes from the defense force. There are members of the retired members of this fund, and they are elected, but we request from them to nominate people who must be members of this board, and they did nominate members, and those members were voted in by the board from the list that was provided. As well as, according to the constitution and the regulations, the board must also consist of a private sector member who we have with the knowledge of managed healthcare, and we have within the board. So I would say all the stakeholders are represented in this board. And then you spoke about the liquidity and bankruptcy and all that. In the status financial status report, we were clear in terms of the liquidity of the fund. If we continue this way without looking at the contribution that the members are paying, without curbing the outsourcing of the fund, definitely the actuaries actually have predicted that if we continue along this line without addressing the contribution of the members, by 2027, this fund will be dead. And therefore, all of the retired members, as well as the very same active members, when they retire, they will have no medical aid, or they will have no medical cover. I'm worried myself. I'm retiring in the next 4 years. And if it goes this way, I know I will have no medical service. I will have to buy medical insurance myself, a medical aid myself, or I will have to go and queue in the government hospital. We know the state of the government hospitals as they are now. So the issue of the solvency of the fund is not in question. Our actuaries have indicated that. And it's not in 10 years, they say by 2026, this fund, if we go along this way, will be non-existent. I think those were the questions from Honorable Marae. Let me attend the issue.
General?
Yes.
Sorry, General. May I just add one more item where I think he had asked, and maybe you didn't complete that, about the outsourcing, who pays. So if I can just add, General, that when an active force member visits a SAMS hospital or sick bay, and if they need to be outsourced, the SAMS will pay for that bill. when a retired VPA member of this fund visits the same hospital and they get outsourced, the fund will pay that bill. So outsourcing is carried by both SAM for its active force members as well as this fund for its retired members. And I'm sure also for the military vets, it would be carried by the Department of Military Veterans as well. So each one would pay their own bills in terms of carrying the cost for the outsourcing. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Jamuna, for that assistance. And then Honorable Shilembe was concerned about the claim rate income, claims rate versus income and the finances. I think I did explain that that question was asked by Honorable Marais. And then the reason why no increase? Well, one of the reasons is that our recommendations to increase were vetoed by the unions. In fact, I think it was last year or 2021, they took us to court and won the case. And therefore, there was no increase. Now, you also ask the issue of dependents, the number of dependents, specifically who are the spouse. Dr. Jamuna, can you, your video, can you?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. So when we spoke
no, I'm
about...
saying, can you...
Oh, sorry.
The video? You ask what is the definition of a spouse. A spouse is a registered member who has been defined as a spouse by the Defense Force, a spouse. So it's not a girlfriend. Any legal spouse, whether you've got three or four, they are recognized by the Defense Force and registered as such. They are considered to be spouse and their children are dependent. Then again, it raises the fact that with the contribution that they are making, if I have one child, I pay the same contribution, and then my friend has got 20 children, they pay the same contribution, but the benefits they get are all the same, irrespective of how many dependents you have. You asked about fraud and corruption. Yes, as part of the measures that were introduced by the interim board and the current board, there were a lot of areas where we found that some service providers were being corrupt, charging exorbitant fees or charging for services that they did not provide. And some of these service providers have been taken to court and be prosecuted and the necessary funds be recovered from them. And some of them were still in the process in the courts where when the cases are won, we hope we will be able to claim the funds back to the fund. I think with regard to Mr. Shilembe, it was those. Dr. Jamuna, did I leave something else?
No, sir, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me go on. And then Honorable Mapanya, you are right. This is a private fund. In fact, I was surprised why it ended in the portfolio committee. You are right. This fund has got no business with the portfolio committee. We don't know how it came here, but I think it's a good thing that the portfolio committee needs to know. And I think their concern does not end with a member when he's still active. A member, they are supposed to look after the interests of a Defense Force member, even when retired. But you are right, Honorable Mapanya, this is a private entity. It should not even be scrutinized by this board. And then you ask, we say it's underfunded from who? It's underfunded because the contributions are not in line with the private medical care and the inflation. The contribution versus the expenditure is not talking the language of being solvent. And therefore, that's why we are saying it's underfunded by 10%. At this stage, luckily, we have not started to disinvest from the monies that we have invested. The good thing is that when the interim board was put in place and put all those measures and the financial position changed, we were able to invest the surplus.
That 1 billion that Dr. Jamuna showed in 2023, those are the invested funds of the members. At the moment, the ratio of claims versus contribution is 100%. So it's even. And if we continue this way, it will start to be negative again. And then, you mentioned the issue of members. You indicate why 19,000 members. Those are the retired members that are 19,000. And then you indicated that the Defense Force has got 90,000. The Defense Force does not have 90,000 members. In fact, the DOD, the Department of Defense, has about 73,000 members. That includes the civilians. And not all those people are contributing members. So the contributing members are only the active uniform members, and those who contribute are only the permanent force members. The MSDS and the reserve don't contribute to this. So the numbers of contributing members, that's why it's about 53,000 of the members. And it's not voluntary. Everybody that is employed and an active force member is a contributor as long as they are permanently employed. Who pays the funds for the services that are provided? I assume here you were asking who pays the SEMS for the services that they provide. We did indicate that this fund pays a nominal fee, very small fee. And that's why Treasury feels that it should be increased. But then again, if they are going to pay more and the SEMS will just go and outsource where they will have to go and cover that outsource fee, this fund will not survive. And you ask whether the money is insured. Well, the money is invested with a reputable company, investment company, and they are liable for those monies that are invested with them. I think that's all the questions. I don't know, Dr. Jamuna, if there's something that you need to add, or anybody.
So if I could just add, I think the issue of the autonomous fund and your comments as to, you know, how did this issue land at this table, but I think for members to actually understand that the Defense Act, through the general regulations, give effect to this fund. So whilst we are, you know, the fund is autonomous, within the broader ambit of the Defense Act, and the general regulations that spell out the nature of the fund and how it should operate. So it does have an arm's length relationship with the DoD, but it's autonomous in terms of the fact that the contributions are coming from members. It's their own individual monies being paid into this entity. There's no government funds coming into the entity. Hence, it's autonomous in terms of its fiduciary responsibility. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe to just add in this regard, I like what Honorable Marais indicated, that the government needs to contribute towards these members. They gave their life during their active years of service. And I do agree with Honorable Marais that the government somehow needs to contribute, because at the moment it's solely their own contribution. And I believe it's not fair. I think as the board, we have raised this matter that some form of funding needs to be given here to this member, to this fund, for it to be viable. Honorable Chair, that's my response for now.
Thank you very much. The fund is established in terms of 1782 to a K. It reads 2K. Let me just check. Yes, it now it's 1K. It's 1K. It reads that the minister the minister may, by notice in the Government Gazette, make regulations regarding Let's go to K regarding the provision for medical, dental, and hospital treatment of retired members of the regular force and their dependents, and if applicable, the establishment, management, and control of one or more funds for such purposes. That's the relationship that this fund has with the department and the committee. I thought I should just go on that so that it's clear where, because unless you understand the role of the fund and its relationship with the Department of Defense, you would not understand the value that it adds as we're discussing it tonight. We look after both the active, the healthcare of the active, and the retirees, and the hospitals, the military hospitals, military one, military two, and military three. Sorry, one military, two military, and three military hospitals were meant precisely to address the issue of both the active and the retirees. The challenges that are faced by these hospitals now has made us to outsource the services at great cost. And now with, and that comes now with the challenges that very soon are going to be experienced by the members. In fact, the active members are starting to experiencing it. Save that the cost, the state picks up 100% cost because they are still in active service. I thought I should just raise that point. And now my hands, I said I would then take the next hands. He said it would be Petle, Motabo, and Raider in that order, please. I'll start with you, Petle.
Good evening, Chairperson and DM and everyone in the platform. Chairperson, I'm even reluctant to make an input. I am confused. I'm confused in a sense that this is a private entity that is not regulated by the legislation that regulates the medical schemes, if I heard it correctly. And the reason I'm raising that, I heard the doctor saying the Council of Schemes, they are sitting on their neck because they are not registered, which they are correct, because they are doing something that is not in line with what the country's legislation wants them to do. That's the first thing. But I don't get it why. But because it's since 1994 it was there. Honorable member raised the question of voluntary. I did not get that response quite clear. Because if it's a voluntary scheme, I don't see where the department should come back in here. Because it's a voluntary scheme with a private entity. And the reason I'm raising that we should not open a can of worms as DOD where all the public sectors will come back and say, if Defence Force is enjoying this, we need to amend the legislation and we must all enjoy because we have been working for the government, all of us. The question of premiums is something that should be in the rules. There shouldn't be any negotiations around that aspect. If the scheme or the fund does have rules that are on a yearly basis regulating how they're going to increase their income so that members can enjoy better benefits as and when they're going on retirement. But if it's a flat rate, something is not correctly done there in terms of the inflation rate, then one rule is not regulated appropriately. There is undermined by the scheme itself. Then on the question of labor refusing, I think it's not labor, it's the very same members that as a scheme you need to request to make a presentation to the members themselves personally direct, not through those who are representing them. Make that particular request to address and give that particular directive. But the 15 rand cannot be a lifetime thing. And then somebody should subsidize. Private sectors, there are too many. The government subsidizes one. Others will also come back and look for that as well. Who elects the trustees? Because trustees should be elected by members. There's no way we're in the legislation where trustees are picked or nominated by someone. The very same members need to converge in terms of the legislation. And then once a year or whatever, how the rules are regulated, then they must have an annual general meeting, elect the people who will represent them, who will from time to time go to them and give a report back and raise the issues that we have just raised, the concerns that they are unable to make an increase on the premiums because they don't have the inside of it. That's how I view it. I may be wrong, but if the members are not electing amongst themselves the trustees, that is going to be a cause for concern. The other thing is that with a small fund of this magnitude, I don't know how many trustees you have. But you should have someone who is having knowledge financially, the chartered accountant, someone who is legally well-vested, someone who is health-wise vested, and then others should be members who are able to make that interaction and provide the kind of education to members as and when they can. And the last thing, Chair, that I can check, say, is that if this fund, what I don't hear, I don't know how their rules are like, to say per year, this is the amount of money that an individual is going to cater. Even if this money can be increased, but if we don't have that cap in terms of the benefits, it's going to be unfortunate. Every year, every time you get this type of a problem, because we see economy is ups and downs, and medical aid is something that is more expensive across the country. And earlier on, somebody raised the question of NHI. I don't think that was correct, but it will be addressed the other day between the department and the NHI. There is a way how everybody is going to be taken care of, particularly those who are having medical aid. Medical schemes need to pay a particular amount of fee, and then so that it can cover subsidize those who are not having anything at all. And then that's the nature of the image. We are subsidizing one another, including the medical scheme. But if these rules in this particular scheme are not changed, I don't see this scheme growing in any way, because they need to change to be in line. They may not be that expensive, but to be in line with how the medical schemes are helping those who does not have, to ensure that at the end of the day, the scheme becomes alive. But if it's voluntarily, it's something else. Premiums, you need to go back and educate those members. There's no way if you just come and say, this is what is happening, this is treasury, then you're going to hit the wall. And someone will say, somebody's prohibiting us because they don't think for others for tomorrow. They are only taking what the mandate is to for the court to give them. Then I think they looked into the legislation, how do they operate in terms of the Pretoria directive on the medical schemes themselves. And if you're not registered, at some stage you may pour money into something, then somebody comes in and says, oh, DOD, you have been paying to this, and this is not registered. How dare you do that as government without checking? So you need to find a way and register so that you are able to can find a way to get that indulgence from the authorities in relation to the scheme that you are having. It's a good phenomenon, but a manner in which it's currently, it's like during the 1964 is quite too long. You need to find an injection in terms of your oaths to pick up and be in line with the current developments. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can you explain this thing of the fund being a voluntary thing before I open it up in case you are missing each other on that one?
Chairperson, maybe to clarify that matter, we did not say it's voluntary. We say every active member of the South African National Defence Force does contribute a premium every month towards the fund during their active years. It's not voluntary.
It is on the basis of that SAMS is able to provide their healthcare once they are in service, as well as when they are out of service.
Chairperson, when they are in service, they are provided health services for free. The government pays 100% for that. The contribution
how does the contribution by the state comes to you? I'm trying to understand that funding part between when it is active, the payment of for services when it's active and when it is in the fund. Can you just explain it a bit on that one?
For active members, as I said, it's a contract that the government, in terms of the regulation, that the government will provide medical care, 100% comprehensive, full comprehensive medical care for a member and his or her dependents when they're in active service. They don't pay a cent. That budget...
In other words, you pick up the bill.
From the budget that were given by Treasure.
The budget that were given by Treasure. Or you pick up 100%. But yes. When it's recovery, then the fund picks up the bill.
The contribution that they pay when they are active goes to their retirement, to this regulation fund. That contribution that they make is specifically for the regular continuation fund when they retire.
That's fine. Members, I thought they should come back on this one because I saw that there was you were misunderstanding each other on this, on that aspect of it being a voluntary association. It's not a voluntary association. All right. Take Ms. Motapo.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good evening to colleagues and DM and officials. Honorable Chairperson, let me align myself with your opening statement regarding this fund. Initially, I was a bit concerned, but when Honorable Mafanya asked a question about whether this is a private or what, and the response by the presenter partially covered me, because I was concerned of this fund being over privatized, but I'm partially answered. So on a lighter note, to Honorable Shelembe, he was very much concerned about spouses. You know, I did not expect that to come from him, especially him coming from KwaZulu-Natal. Because the customary law allows this issue of polygamy. So it's not surprising, because in the South African National Defense Force, obviously we'll have men who will be involved in a polygamous marriage. So issue of spouses is not so foreign to us as Africans.
I think out of order.
Sorry. You will come back. If you want to make a follow up, I will ask you. I will indicate and I will allow you to do it.
I believe those comments from a member are wholly inappropriate at another member's assistance. I don't think that's right.
You are all in the meeting, and if she did not get your call, let her finish, we'll come back to correct it. Continue.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chair, for protecting me. I was just giving them a free lecture on customary law. They should thank
you. There's another inappropriate comment that I don't believe is appropriate in a committee meeting of Parliament.
Chair. Chair, can you protect the lady, please?
Mr. Speaker, you will come after her. Don't interject. I'm sure I would not like people to interject when you're on the platform. Continue, Ms. Honorable Motapo.
Thank you for protecting me, Honorable Chairperson. So also, I would like to say, Honorable Ted covered me on the issue of NHI, and thank you so much for now.
Thank you. Are you done?
I'm done. When people attack you, you seem to forget even issues you are supposed to raise. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Please don't do that. You're actually disrupting her chain of thoughts. Right. And I now take Mr. Rader.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, before I start, I would like to point out that the rules of Parliament, specifically the joint rules of Parliament, govern the goings on during our committee meetings. Mr. Shalembe is well within his rights to raise a point of order as a result. And furthermore, casting aspersions or making condescending statements to other members is inappropriate and extreme. So I do ask members to maintain appropriate decorum. And while the honourable member did indicate that it was the lighter note, I do feel that the comments made were inappropriate, and hence me coming to injecting. And I thought it was appropriate on a point of order, Chair. But I know your ruling. I just want to emphasise that the rules of debate still take precedence during our meetings. Chair, relating to my question.
You're in a meeting. You're not debating. You're commenting. And the problem in the House is that when your time has passed, you have no way of coming back. Yet in a meeting, he still can come back and correct any misunderstanding. Let's just leave it to me. I will manage it. Thanks.
Noted, Chair. I'll leave it at noted. Thank you. Chair, let's move on to the case at hand. And I do want to make a point that I am quite concerned about reckless trading by this entity. Now, reckless trading is a very specific thing that's detailed in law, and it has serious repercussions for people. I'm not sure that noting how some of the trustees and the board members are allocated, I really hope that they have been appropriately trained and informed of their responsibilities, their fiduciary responsibilities, in terms of discharging their business as board members and/or trustees, however it is structured. Because I do think that people might be voted into positions and then have some sort of liability that accrues to them unintentionally. Reckless trading is a serious issue, and with the repeated warnings from actuaries that have been made regarding this entity and the limited action, I do believe that that this is something that is quite serious to deal with. Chair, that's point one. Chair, point two, this obviously relates, this entity obviously deals mostly with military veterans. And whilst I have enjoyed learning about it tonight, I'm not convinced that the discussion of this particular matter belongs in the Joint Planning Committee on Defence. It may be housed better for future dissection in the Committee of the National Assembly, the Standing Committee on Defence, or the Portfolio Committee on Defence, I beg your pardon. So just a matter of procedure again there. Because I think that was the point was just made very clear by you in your most recent follow-up question and response received from the presenters, that this really is, it's a fund that's set up to protect or to provide services to veterans to ensure that they're accommodated. Chair, and then perhaps my last point. I'm a little confused as to the reason that we really are here. It's almost a case of someone waving a flag to say, hi, we're in trouble. We may need a bailout in a few years' time. So we're letting you know that we are not able to fund ourselves. We're still okay for now, but in future we might be in trouble. The concern I have there, Chair, is that if this matter doesn't get carried through properly to a handover report of this committee, or perhaps your portfolio committee, the threat may well be lost. And then when the time does come that someone says, oh, we need a bailout, it's going to be a case of, well, we told Parliament this in 2023. We warned you it was going to happen. So I do think we need to properly understand what the intention is behind raising these issues tonight. Is it to raise a warning flag? And Chair, as I say, I think this is clearly a complex topic that many of us have struggled to follow and understand until your recent clarity bits at the end there, which I think brought a whole lot of strings together. But it's certainly, I believe, going to require further interrogation and perhaps deeper understanding for the members of Parliament responsible to properly make the right decisions or propose the right decisions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Shelembe, do you want to come in just to, without debating the issue, just clarify your point and the area of misunderstanding before I invite the fund as well as the SAMS to respond. Or there's Musumai, but just you may come in if you want to say anything before I call on before I invite Musumai.
No, Chair, my concern, Chair, is that when we are here in the committee, we are expressing, our views, and we are asking questions. So now I was asking a question. I understand what is a polygamy. It's not an issue. Now, if I'm asking the person, say, please, now, I'm getting the point where they say many spouses. I was trying to get the clarity whether that issue of spouses is including maybe people who are not, officially married. Now, the question was answered properly. Now, for the member to just come and grandstand using my name, it's inappropriate. That question was answered, and I don't understand what's the need now to grandstand using that. So, Chair, that's all that I can say. I didn't argue the issue of polygamy. I said I need clarity how do they define on their side. Thank you.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Even though you misunderstood each other. I don't think she was understanding. At least now you have clarified the point. Let's leave it at that. Motomai, your point?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine is not so much. I just want to remind Chair that
our military veterans, as we speak, we are approaching December. And most of them, they are dying. I heard one was talking about the dependents. And these people, after they pass on, they just left their families, their children. Some of them, they don't have even a house to stay. Can the DM look on this issue? Because last time, he even assisted a person who was using oxygen during the COVID. But I just want to say people are now very sick, especially the military veterans. We must consider their issue so that they can get their benefit as soon as they can. I thank you, Chair.
Okay. I think we've covered all the hands. Let me just double check that. I think, yes. All right. Now, I invite the department to, I invite comments from the presenters.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's the Assistant General again. The first question, comments were from Honorable Pesce. Yes, most of the issues that the Honorable raised were comments, and our response to that was that the board, from the interim board to the current board, has made the recommendations in terms of the regulations that govern this fund to be reviewed and be made to be in line with the current functioning or where the fund finds itself functioning, mostly in the private sector. Let's remember, this fund was not meant to be getting services from the private sector. It was meant to get services solely from the firms. And due to the challenges that are faced by the SNDF, we find the firms being in an environment where it was not designed to be. So we have made recommendations for these regulations to be amended, to be put in line with the environment in which the fund is functioning. With regards to registration as a medical scheme, the presenter did indicate that the interim board as well as the current board has requested that in line with other security agencies like the state security agency, who their medical fund is not registered as a medical scheme and then they enjoy certain benefits, we are in the process of getting these funds to be exempted to be part of the medical schemes and be considered as a medical fund that is not classified as a medical scheme, because being a medical scheme comes with its own complications. So most of the issues raised by Honorable Pesce were comments, and we appreciate that, as well as Honorable Mutapo. I think it was a comment. Honorable Reiters, yes, your issue of fiduciary responsibilities of the board. The board is fully aware, and they've been given training more than once. And most of the board members that are in this board are appointed there based on their expertise. We have experts in finance, we have got legal advisors, we have got members who are dealing with medical schemes in the private sector to advise us. There are actuaries who are providing advice, as well as auditors. They look at this fund in order to advise board members. So in terms of reckless trading, yes, we are fully aware of that, and that's why all board members are trained so that they know their responsibilities. Should I go on, Shepard?
Okay, go on, Sachin. I thought you were done. Continue.
No. I think, the issue raised by Honorable Mutsama, I think the we must not confuse this fund and the military veterans. I think that comment by Honorable Mutsamai is meant for the military veterans. And this one in the context of the South African, the Department of Defense, we have the MILVET and then we have the retired members of the Defense Force who belong to this fund. Honorable Chair, unless Dr. Jamuna, if I missed something, if you can add, I think most of the comments here were just that comments and statements I submit.
Yes, sir. Just to add, I think the one member mentioned, you know, this whole relationship of ours here, and I think it's just important for members to understand that we regularly do presentations to the MCC, you know, the Military Command Council. So it's not as if, you know, we are so far away in terms of how we operate and that the main stakeholders know of what's going on. And all of these, the information in terms of the financials and the increases that need to be done are tabled at that forum at the MCC. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. No, it's fine. The DM was listening. He may want to say one or two words on this. I think it's not the first time he's received a presentation of this nature. And but I want to add this, that if I look at the position of the fund, was precisely was not looking at the medical aid being primarily medical care being primarily provided by the private sector. The state was meant to continue to provide the service through its own hospitals and other health care facilities. Unfortunately, the challenges facing the department's health care facilities, especially one military hospital and possibly the two and three as well, to a lesser degrees. Those challenges I now have really put the fund under pressure in that SAMS has to outsource. SAMS has to outsource services. In other words, they only go to private healthcare that is approved by SAMS. Am I correct, Dr. Jamuna?
Sir, so there's some services that would be used by the SAMS. However, there are certain providers that we would have negotiated with that the SAMS would then refer the members to those hospitals. Yes, yeah.
They must still be approved by SAMS as isn't that they are providing those services on behalf of SAMS? SAMS can't offer, and then SAMS authorize them to come into the space.
Yes, but because we kind of have a negotiating muscle, then we are able to afford better negotiations to allow our members to use those different facilities. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
But I would leave it at that for now. And me invite the DM to say to it. Maybe at some point we'll have to meet. Yes, maybe at some point we'll have to talk to. Maybe there's a question I've not asked. I'll recognize Mr. Mare. The Defense Service Commission, I think we need to talk to them, check. I don't know the extent to which they've inquired into this aspect. And maybe we should give them the chance to go into it and come and report to us. And only then we can take it up when we have a recommendation on the table. You want to say something?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to ask, can we have a contact or a designation that if we receive complaints or inquiries, that we can at least have somebody say, okay, here's a contact person, here's an email address, please approach this person to deal with your medical or your doctors or your service providers concerns. That will be much appreciated. It will help us, and it will allow us to actually support our members, our retirees, and also the medical fund. Thank you.
Do you really want them to come to us, Mr. Marais? I would rather open. So let me finish. I would rather not open up that avenue. And if I have a problem, I have my own medical aid permit. And it uses med scheme to as the administrator. If I have a problem, I approach a permit and I get them to sort it out. If I were to go via, I would actually be threatening other people necessarily. Yeah, that is you.
Yeah, no, I don't want to take over the work. With the greatest of respect, I just need that if we get that, in the case that we get that we don't have to, you know, be bothered with that and eventually, you know, we talk about what is in the best interest of our soldiers and our retirees, that we can at least say, here's a contact person, yeah, send your stuff through to them. So that's it. Just an address to say, there's a service that we provide you. We are thankful for the service that you provided for us, but this is in the hands between you and your fund now. That's all.
Please deal with that, Surgeon General. And also, you said, because the issue is continuation members, and I've looked at the composition of your board, and it only refers to one member co-opted, one member from the reserve force co-opted. But you said they provide a list and so on. Not clear to me how, by what right, in fact, how they get onto the board, and that when they're on the board, they have the same right as any other member of the board. And how many are they? You see, that's where the issue is. That now you hear Maria saying, well, if they come to us, we need to know who to refer the matters to. But if they have their own representation, they know exactly that we have so-and-so, two or three, four, whatever the number, representing us as continuation members, at least there's a platform that is there where all of the board members who represent all the stakeholders are there to engage on the issues. And you may want to do that.
Yeah, thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Firstly, with the information that is required, being asked by Honorable Marais, in the presentation, we did indicate that as part of getting in touch with all our members, we went on roadshows where we, with registers that we have, that we managed to reach almost all of our members, visiting them in the areas that they've identified that they will be able to come and meet us, so that they can be educated in terms of measures that have been put in place to manage the fund and be able to let them know how they should contact the fund at any time. And we have also indicated that we have modernized the communication with our members on the ground. We will agree that at this day and age, if there is anybody of the type of members that we have who may not have a cell phone or have a friend or a neighbor without a cell phone, I think it's virtually, probably, if it's there, it will be less than 0% of people without a cell phone. So we are in touch with all our members. They have the contact details of the complaint center at the headquarters where this fund is based. So they can phone in and submit whatever complaint they have. And I can assure you, Honorable Chair, that all our members and the dependents are able to reach us at any time, any day. Now, With regards to the composition of the board, it's not reserve. Reserves are not contributors to this fund, and therefore they are not members of this fund. However, in the board, we have members that are elected by the members themselves. They nominate members to be considered to be part of the board, and we have two members, retired members, who are part of the board. They were nominated from the ground by the members themselves, and they gave us the name, and then the board chose two people from those based on their expertise, as well as the members showing us what qualifications they have in terms of the value that they can add into the board. So the members that are two members from the retired, the members of the regular continuation are members of the board, and they have full rights in terms of voting within the board in order to influence any decision we take. So I just think I covered it. Dr. Jamuna, if I left something, you may add.
I think you've covered.
Thank you. Yeah. If I could just add, Chair, the general regulations stipulate all of this. It actually lists out what the composition of the board ought to be. It actually lists out the number of people of the different portfolios, as it were, that need to be, on the board. What makes up constitutes the board of trustees, and all members, anybody is more than welcome to go and look at the Defence Act and the general regulations, chapter 15, part 4, that gives effect to all of this, and all of the information is contained there, sir, and even access on our website, all the regulatory information is available. Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm.
Maybe a yes or no answer. Do you hold annual general meetings?
Well, it's not an AGM per se, because the board is the representation for the members that sit on the board. That's how it is.
So there is no forum where it's forum of all members, those who can attend?
No.
Wanted just to get that. DM, I think we've covered this point. You may want to wind up, just make your final comment on it.
Yes, thank you very much, and to committee members for the reflections on the state of affairs as far as the medical continuation fund of the reserve force members. Of the regular force members. To save the committee time, Chair, let me say that the responses provided by the Surgeon General, I have found them illuminating those areas, those corners that may not have been sufficiently, fleshed out. I want to thank him and his colleague, Dr. Jamuna, for their information sharing with the Joint Standing Committee. It is, Chair, obvious that this discussion has been occasioned by the submissions of the actuarial report, and importantly that the fund's liability has over doubled since 2019. That, of course, is a matter of concern. But what should give us comfort, Chair, is that graph of what happened in the crisis encountered before, how they were able to recover from it. And there are, successes that the report, the presentation points to, and I think we should take note of that.
that there is improved governance in this body. Prudent financial management has also been, worked upon and achieved. Internal audit interventions on the possibilities of fraud investigations have been done by internal audit interventions. Technology employment utilization has also been taken care of. So those are the things which the successes which tells me that it is a strong enterprise, this medical continuation fund. It is a strong enterprise, and I would say that the concerns of Mr. Bond, and rightfully so, about any possibility of this entity involved in transgressions that would constitute reckless trading, that concern, from what I can see, and what the Surgeon General has shared about what is the practice within management practice within the entity, gives me comfort that indeed we should not be unduly concerned about the possibilities of transgressions there. If it's reckless trading that we are worried about, Chair, when you look at when this enterprise was established, we're talking 60 years. It would be 60 years of reckless trading. The record doesn't suggest that the enterprise is as weak as that. It's been there for 60 years. It will bounce back. There are issues, though, that I have noted that I would imagine the Military Command Council, because they report to the Military Command Council. The Military Command Council must bring to the Council on Defense, and they relate to, in the conclusion, the strategic priorities that they are pointing out to there. There are submissions that we need to look at a review of the general regulations and amendments of the human resource policies. The details thereof, I would imagine, will be, articulated properly for us to see, because now it means that the ministry must come in. There must be policy amendments of some sort there. It is the obligation that we have in the ministry as far as this matter is concerned. The point about it being a private fund, the way the Surgeon General has explained, I have noted that our legislation does not, the impression that it does not protect it the way the state security similar fund is protected in their own legislation. And that is something that we can look into, Chair. And the department should be able to come back with an indication of what it is they propose we consider in setting in our principal act. With that, Chair, I would submit that the exchange was a useful one. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We will follow up on the matters, including the status, to ensure that it is protected and is see, of course, the level of protection will have to be looked at closely, because what makes it not, what makes this entity not a public entity, as it were, is because it's not funded by the state. It's funded through private funds that are deducted from the members themselves. And if it were to be funded by the state, it would meet the definition of a public entity, because a public entity is an entity created by legislation, which this is, and funded partly or wholly by the state. And when it meets these two conditions, then it makes it accountable to Parliament. But in this case, it doesn't meet the second one. It's created by statute, but is not partly nor fully funded by the state. That makes, therefore, it not to be accountable to government. But we still have interest, because it talks to members, the care of members of the force. We want to leave it at that, but we will look at the exemption that has been proposed. But hence, I've requested the DFC, the Defence Service Commission, to look into this matter and see what they have to propose. If that comes from them, and of course, we'll have to see how we take it forward. Thank you very much. We'll leave it at that for now. And thank you very much, Dr. Chitabona. Thank you very much, Surgeon General. It was a meeting to support the two of you. It's been a good presentation. We're now now know what the fund is all about and how it assists our members and the challenges it is facing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister. Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
We now to the second or third item, one, two, three, fourth item. It's a presentation on the and papers. Let me just check if the Chief CJ Ops is in the meeting. I don't know, maybe the Chief of Staff would want to say one or two words before I invite the Chief Joint Ops.
Chairperson, thank you very much. CJ Ops is in the meeting indeed. The presentation, Chair, as we know, it is what we always do as requested by the committee. And Chief of Joint Operations is ready to do exactly that. It's quite short, and he will be able to take us through, and thereafter we should be able to discuss the presentation. With your permission, Chair, may I allow CJ Ops to carry on with the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Over to CJ Ops.
Good evening, Chairperson and Co-Chairperson, and the members of the honourable members of the committee. Also wish to pass my greetings to the Deputy Minister of Defence and Military Veterans, and the acting secretaries and other members of the Defence Force that are in attendance. Chair, the presentation will be very short, as standard and norms. The committee had requested that we brief the committee on the Presidential Force Employment Authority for the SNDF deployment for illegal mining under Operation Prosper. The aim is to present to you, honourable members, and amplify the decision and approval of the President of the country and the Commander-in-Chief for the SANDF to be deployed inside the country in support of the and in cooperation with the SAPS. Now, taking you through to just three slides where we are confirming that the President has authorized the employment of the SANDF for service in cooperation with the SAPS with the prevention and combating of crime and the maintenance and preservation of law and order in the Republic of South Africa under Operation Prosper. This is in accordance with the provisions of Section 201, Section 2 Alpha of the Constitution of the RSA of 1996, Section 18 and 31 of the Defence Act as amended. The deployment of the SANDF is part of the security cluster efforts to address the prevailing high level illicit mining and the related brazen organized crime, where illegal miners carry with them illegal rifle caliber weapons, explosives, and also torture and harass communities residing in the vicinity of the disused mining areas. Chair and members of the committee, we are confirming that a complement of 3,300 members of the SANDF will be deployed under Operation Prosper in support and assisting the security cluster in the fight against illegal mining and the related criminality across the country. This is important, Chair, that is the main focus and what triggered is illegal mining. But with this illegal mining, we've seen over the period, it is quite a broad range of criminal activities that take place, mainly in the vicinity or in the areas of illegal mining, but also extended into the nearby areas. And the other criminality that prevails there is quite a number of undocumented persons that are part of this and are around those areas, which means it's bringing in illegal foreign nationals purely triggered by their intent or to be involved in illegal mining. So there is a multiplicity of criminality, which under Operation Prosper we are authorized. We cannot then deploy elements only to focus on one singular area or issue of illegal money, whereas there's quite a number of spin-offs coming out of that. We are confirming that the employment is authorized to deploy for a period of 6 months over the period 28 October till the 28 October 2023 to 28 April 2024. We are confirming that the mission-specific rules of engagement and conduct for this deployment are in place. Members are being trained on this. It is very important to us as the SANDF and particularly us in operations that we ensure that our members and soldiers who are deployed adhere to the rules of engagement and conduct that are set. As we are experiencing in other environments in other areas where rules governing the conduct of war are being compromised in one way or another. So we are making sure that that gets avoided. In slide number three, we are confirming that the estimated expenditure to be incurred is to the amount of 492,143,000. Broken down to compensation of employees and goods and services. Compensation of employees, 206 million, and goods and services, 235 million. We also wish to bring the committee to the attention that the cost for this deployment is unfunded. in the financial year 23-24 DOD financial allocation. And we consider that as unforeseen and unavoidable, which then requires certain actions or steps to be taken to address that we are deploying with no funding allocation for the specific operation, because it's something that cropped up unforeseen and unavoidable. So yes, there are steps that the secretariat and the planners are engaging on such that the cost and expenditure is covered accordingly. We wish to bring to your attention, members of the committee, that there is a semblance of some funding allocation that has been promised to the DOD and other JCPS departments and entities from the CARA funding. There has been a determination that the SNDF will be provided with 155 million out of the CARA funding for this deployment, but up to so far, we have not received any funding. We remain hopeful and wishing that we get. However, when you compare this with estimated expenditure is way low. So yes, there will be need for National Treasury or to avail funding for us to do the work at hand. This is the end of report. Members of the committee and Deputy Minister, I submit.
Thank you very much. All right. Colleagues, the matter is on the table. Thank you very much, General, for your presentation. My only apprehension about this exercise, General, and DM, because the Deputy Minister is in the meeting, is that we were spending half a billion rand, is what has been proposed, for a period of about 6 months. And without reinforcing, strengthening our borderline security, because that's where the problem is. And you deal with these people, remove them, take them back home. But what will stop them from coming back? And now when they are back, are we going to spend another half a billion rand taking them out and sending them back home? And for how long? So yet, if all our investment as a country was directed at strengthening our borderline security, ensuring that people don't come, who want to come to South Africa, go through the border gate and get recorded there, we'll continue to have this problem. And it's a problem, a very big problem. And however, we welcome this because they're already in the country and the community, they're harassing our community there. They've taken over and they carry high caliber rifle and posing threat and danger to our citizens, and they deserve protection. My message to the citizens of South Africa is that they must give you space together with the police to get rid of this problem. And they must not come near you because that's an area of operation. Like in all areas of operation where we've deployed soldiers, we expect citizens to stay away and allow you to operate. And but the intention is not to interfere with their daily lives, but to ensure that they don't get caught up in a crossfire. Over to you, Mare. You wanted to say something?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Obviously, we must take note of the letter and the presentation. Thank you, General. My concern is still, you know, that it is unfunded. And Chair, obviously, we will have to take it up with National Treasury and with that fund. That one must remember, they've just taken away 700 million rand from our baseline budget, and you know, 1.2 billion is the cost of employees. Now, obviously, this will have an effect on the defence force if we do not get the funds back, and I think that must be our effort. And I thank you for that. I just wanted to ask the general the kind of training that was provided to I see today in the defence web. That is the I think is the light armored brigade that has been prepared. What kind of training is required to do a deployment of this nature? And I just want to say that we have got enormous appreciation for what the soldiers are doing under incredibly difficult circumstances. So I mean, I will never blame our soldiers. If I've got concerns, I will never address it to them, because they follow orders. So thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. And Honorable Thabo Motle, and then I thought I saw Raider's hand. Let me just check if it is still there. It's going to be Honorable Motle and then Honorable Raider.
Thank you, Chair, and good evening. I just wanted to raise one matter for clarification. Chair, as you have raised your concern around the deployment, its objective, whether it will address the problem permanently or not. But you see, maybe CJ Ops can take us into confidence, because as much as Chair, you asked that question, we know for a fact that the defense force in this particular deployment, what is their role and the limitation that they are confronted with in terms of enforcing the law. They are there to support the police. In fact, for a lack of a better word, the layman can say they are there as a security of the police, because the police must be the ones that are executing the job, and the soldiers are there to guard the police. What is it that CJ Ops, you are going to do differently to ensure that the law is enforced? Have you engaged, because previously when we engaged with you, you explicitly told us your frustration insofar as this deployment is concerned. To say you've got limitations, you cannot do certain things to ensure that you enforce the law. what is it that you are going to do differently? Because these are some of the things, Chair, that we must engage in, because there's a lot of money pumped in, and it can't be just pumped in so that the soldiers become securities of the police. It must be an effective exercise on the ground in terms of the objectives that we want to achieve. It also speaks to training of soldiers for such deployments internally, because we know they are not trained for this, particularly for this kind of operations. But what are the challenges that they are confronted with, and what is it that they think should be done to address those challenges in order for them to assist us to achieve the objectives that the governments want to achieve? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mutle. Honorable Reiter.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think Mr. Mutle has made some good points. You know, this is not a military function, it's not a defense function, this is a police function, and members of the defense force are not adequately trained, not appropriately trained, to take on these duties. Now, it is depressing, Chair, that government has, through failures in other areas, brought up to a point where this has now become necessary. And I believe it is necessary that strong hand is shown, and I do believe that probably bringing in the Defence Force is a response to many citizens who have indicated that this is got to a stage now where a stronger hand needs to be taken. So understanding why we are doing what we're doing, I don't believe we should have allowed ourselves to get to this position, to therefore sit with a budget that is clearly been stated is unfunded, is inappropriate. And I think that this needs to be taken with Treasury. The fact that, you know, police has received additional funding in the current adjustment, and yet again the Defence Force is being called upon to come in and assist them in performing their duties. This is very concerning, Chair, from a sustainability of the Defence Force going forward. I believe that a strong comment needs to be made in terms of saying that you know, as more and more reliance is placed on the Defence Force, we need to keep an eye on the budget, and just say that you know, proper funding is absolutely imperative to enable further interventions like this to take place. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. You are actually reminding me that I must ask the team in the portfolio to quickly, I don't know if we can still do it, amend our bids so that we post a section on this deployment, and ask the Minister of Finance to comment. Because as you are saying, we've passed the adjustments. It was tabled just some few weeks back. Unless we have another adjustments budget or appropriation before the end of the financial year, the department will have to fund this from its own budget, meaning they have to cut other services to make funds available for this budget. It was never budgeted for because it was not envisaged. And there is no money. The budget was, the department was projecting to overspend even the very same budget it has got. Now with this added responsibility that is not funded, it will make the situation even worse. So I'm really praying that there be an adjustment appropriation to cater for this before the end of the financial year. But of course, if we put it in our bidable plan, it will be the opportunity to get the minister to comment on it. But I'm not too sure if we can still do it, but I will have to inquire with the table in Parliament.
Yeah, we will anyway support you in that.
Okay, that I was going to ask for support. Any objection to that, if it's possible? Okay, there's no objection.
No objection, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mutle. And Chief Joint, let me, I don't know, I start with you, Chief of Staff, I don't know, let's see how you deal with this between yourself and the Chief Joint. After that, the Deputy Minister will then make his final comment.
The Chairperson, Chief Joint can go first, and then I will follow after him.
Thank you very much, Chief Joint.
Thank you, Chairperson and members. Thank you for the contributions, and also we appreciate that you are going to be also part of us in terms of securing the required and necessary financial allocation for the SANDF to do its work. Honorable Ryder, I start with you, and you indicated that yes, a strong hand is necessary at this stage. And I'm of the opinion that that statement says everything. That's why it is necessary. And it's just seen fit that the military can come in and just bring that bit of a strong hand. We are non-apologetic on that, that the military, we're an element of force. We enforce where things are not done correctly. So bit of a strong hand, and we have a belief that the population has respect of the military and tend to comply much more better when is military around. And the strong hand is much more focused on the criminal elements. Having the country having experienced that they are now using quite a lot of firefight as well as explosives, then we are capable to meet them and engage with them in that environment, which might have been not as easy with other law enforcement entities. So when it comes to criminals and they open fire against us, we are going to open fire. We are going to get to where they are in terms of when they are explosives, and also bring a semblance of protection to communities in those surrounding areas that are now being harassed and tortured. Honorable Mare asked what kind of training is being undertaken. The members are just undergoing what you call mission readiness or mission specific training, reviving their previous training, but it is particular to what is the conditions and what we are faced with and what operation we are doing. It's just that refresher so that they are fully ready to undertake this task. Honorable Mutle, you raised issues of what is the role of the SANDF and what are we going to do differently this time during this operation? There's not much that we'll do differently. We still have the same capabilities that we currently have. There is no new or advanced capabilities. But with our training and expertise, you will understand that there's a part of when we are doing training of counter-insurgency operations, which used to call COIN, which is applicable in this case. Then we bring in that knowledge and expertise and apply it. But the general challenges of the military in peacetime will still prevail, and we we are now able to manage and succeed and still do our work. Like you said, it is the ideal situation, but if we do not have the ideal, we still need to satisfy our mandate to defend the Republic of South Africa. So we are in the space that we are defending the Republic of South Africa. There will be quite a number of sacrifices that we are going to do achieve. And also, I said I bring to attention that we are not alone. We are part of the security cluster led by the JCPS, and quite a number of departments are involved in this issue of illicit mining and illegal mining. And the military is just going to play its own particular role, which will provide conditions for the experts from DMM, Department of Mineral and Resources, to go into these disused mines, where necessary, close those mines or close the shafts, and or whatever is necessary from the energy department and environment, the police. We also have space to do their policing work and arrest. So we are a force multiplier to all of these other departments. And we also have interest that our country becomes stable and not just be roamed around by a gun-carrying criminals. I think that is our contribution as well. Yes, in future, we are looking at it. Technology is something that is important, but for now, we'll soldier on and successfully so. Chairperson Kwaba, yes, you're quite correct that prevention is better than cure. If and when we have our borders proper and very legal or no illegal cross-border movement, then we'll have achieved almost 90% of criminal challenges that we are facing, meaning we have done prevention. And when these crop up, the SAPS and other entities, law enforcement entities will be able to handle. But because of the big floods of undocumented foreign nationals, it tends to be a very a big challenge, and we agree, and we are trying all that we could as the SANDF in our space for the borderline to improve. We are hopeful in 2 years there will be a difference. I can say that, Honorable Chair, that in 2 years' time, we might be seeing quite a lot of developments in the space, which will contribute to reduction of criminality. Chair, I believe I've covered the questions. Most of it were comments, and also just support from your good friends to us and wishing us to make a difference and succeed. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. We are sending you out to stabilize the situation and come back. And in other words, we are supporting the president on this exercise. DM, your closing remarks.
And honorable members, indeed, the deployment we are discussing now is a necessary and responsible decision. It is just the right thing for the country to do. The president's decision is very appropriate. And already the feedback from the broad members of the public or members of the broad public is its excitement, and that the intervention has actually come too late. it is an intervention we should have considered much earlier. For very obvious reasons, Chair and Honourable Members.
Please take down the presentation. Sorry, DM.
Okay.
You may continue, DM. I was asking him to take down the presentation. Thank you.
Yeah. Chair, no decent country today across the globe has its resources exploited and plundered under force of arms. It is a very primitive problem that we are encountering. It does not belong to the organized modern world of today, where you have non-nationals, people coming from outside of a country, involved in exploiting resources by force of arms. There are problems of exploitation of resources of countries by forces beyond their shores. But it would always be the national, the citizen of those countries who are involved in the actual activity themselves of extracting whatever is being extracted, and those who are exploiting those resources will only be there to collect. In this instance, we have non-citizens by force of arms extracting resources that are meant for citizens of this country. It is a primitive problem that we have. It's in the orderly world, it doesn't exist, that problem. Not even in our neighbor, in the region. There's no country in Southern Africa, in SADC, that is by force plundered of its resources under force of arms. It's not there in SADC. So the decision is appropriate. But with that said, Chair, of course, the comment you have made is very appropriate. To say we're going to be spending $500 million as the defense function in 6 months. If that $500 million was what we were provided with, and we had proactively utilized that $500 million, those are enormous resources that we could have addressed some of the very strategic important challenges that we must address. One of which, as you were saying, is providing security management of our borderline. We would have spent with $500 million if we had it. It would be money that is used on the basis of plans. Would have planned for it. But now we are going to use it, of course, because of unforeseen and unavoidable circumstances. I'm just saying value for money is unfortunately not optimized. And even in relation to the very same responsibility we are undertaking, this rapid internal deployment of our defense force, we need, as we have agreed, we need to capacitate our defense force for that purpose, in relation to the equipment that they need, but also in relation to the training, as some members have already, you know, commented. But with the $500 million that we have, that is not going to happen. And we may actually encounter again another problem that requires rapid deployment, and the systems and the training will still remain the one that we have at this point. So
I am saying I appreciate the sentiment of the committee, but we all agree that this is one unforeseeable and unavoidable situation for us to spend as much from out the budgets of government as we are going to be spending. Because if we don't, then the citizens will lose faith in the security of the state. But going forward, it is what the oversight must have to put pressure that to make money available at the point when you have a problem. In defense, in military business, it's not the best way of going about things. With that said, Chair, the comments of the committee have been they are recognized. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would urge the communication of the Defence Force to communicate this thing to communities around those mining areas where we are experiencing this problem, but lastly to those who we are aiming at removing from the mines, that if they don't live on their own, that if they don't live on their own, they will be creating, they'll be forcing the defense force and the security forces of our country to remove them. I think we need that message to go out. And I think it's the first exercise of its own that we are engaged in, that I'm aware of, where we are targeting a particular group and saying to them, you live or we'll force you out. You live on your own or we'll force you out. So it's a targeted group, and we know where they are in those mines. Even means distributing pamphlets, using aircraft, your aircraft, SNDF, distributing them in those areas. You may know the languages that these people are speaking. And a warning that we have arrived. And we have been experiencing this problem, and the communities have been complaining about it. And we now think it's the time that we act. Remember, the only time you'll be allowed to come back is when you have removed them from those mines. We start with sending out those warning messages. I'm sure the team in the competition is listening to this, and I don't think it will be that expensive, and because it's we are basically saying we have now declared a war on you. Well, we're not saying, but war in a inverted commas. If you don't move, we'll remove you. All right. I just want to leave it at that. If it could be taken in that spirit, and would appreciate it, because that would actually mean that less will alleviate a lot of problems if they can live on their own. I just want to leave it at that without going into it too much on it. All right, because we have now declared the defense force. I mean, it means we are serious as a country. It's the last authority. We are securing the last line of defense. In other words, the state stamping its authority. But if we win this, if we lose this one, then we'd lose the country will lose confidence. We lose confidence in the defense force. I thought I should just say that in passing. Colleagues, I think we have, I'm not quite certain if I did ask the general, the COS to say, I might have skipped him.
Yes, you have.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Indeed, yes. I was skipped. But like I said, Chair, once the Deputy Minister has spoken, he has spoken on behalf of all of us. And I want to thank you. We always appreciate the support by this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, General. So, okay. So the message is loud and clear. So you are released so that you go and gather and ensure that our deployment is reinforced and is ready to do the job there. Thank you very much, Future Ops, for your presentation. It's DM, I think we have come to an end. Thank you as well. And all other members from the DOD who came to support you, DM. So we thank you. We can now more quickly move to the last item, is the minutes. Nandipa, is the only...
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you. Honorable Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you.
Is the only such Nandipa? Is said that to have gone over time, and I don't want to delay the meeting.
Yes, Chair, we only have one set, and we can adopt it next week, Chair.
We can adopt it next week. Okay, yes. That's fine. And we are going... I think it's the Johnston Committee that is going, we are responding to the invite by Milko. And for some reason, they gave us the mandates that were available that they could host us on. And so we chose this Monday. And it so happens that this Monday is preceded by a voter registration, and that might actually affect a number of our colleagues who will be doing some work over the weekend and may not be able to fly into Cape Town in time to be with us on Monday. So we understand that very well, and those who go there would represent us. Colleagues, if it was out of our planning, would have chosen a date that was not a Monday or any other day, but we got this day, and in fact it was Monday, but this one we thought would not have the problem, but unfortunately there is a challenge with it. So those who can come, who are available, please indicate. I know some have. Please continue to indicate so that we plan accordingly. Thank you very much, colleagues. The meeting stands adjourned.